thanks for coming out tonight. I know it's a Friday and it's kind of rainy, and it's fantastic that you're all here. For those who don't know, Blue Stockings is an all-volunteer run space. Do feminist and activist sort of events, and obviously bookstore. And I'm going to be passing around this to get folks to donate if they feel like it, which you're encouraged to do. I'm a volunteer. My name's Joshua. I'm also fortunate to be on the board of the Institute for Anarchist Studies with Maya, which is one of the organizations involved in tonight's book. And the book this evening, Decolonizing Anarchism, is a sort of history of South Asian anti-colonial movements and resistance movements, and putting those in conversation with anarchism to sort of propose a notion of national liberation that doesn't necessarily see a state as its objective, and also a notion of anarchism that goes beyond some of the more conventional notions of being just typically anti-state and anti-capitalist, but having an analysis of other forms of hierarchy and domination. And while I have Maya here, I want to note that she's also part of a project we're doing called the Lexicon Series, which is a series of sort of encyclopedia-like entries on specific terms that are getting thrown around a lot, specifically in the Occupy movement, terms like power, race, gender, colonialism, and Maya has contributed one of the pieces on colonialism, and will also be part of a panel that the Left Forum panel is called, I think it's called De-Occupy, Decolonize, something. It's a panel that we coordinated for the Left Forum that's part of an IAS track of panels related to anarchism and the Occupy movement. The panel that Maya is going to be part of is specifically about the politics of colonialism in the Occupy movement, both the sort of vernacular of Occupy, but also the politics of race and colonialism as they express themselves within this movement as it unfolds. So I hope you all will check that out and join us there. Maya is a board member with the Institute for Anarchist Studies, as I mentioned. She also teaches at NYU and is involved with a number of projects here. She's probably the most overcommitted person I know. So let's welcome Maya.
Yeah, so thank you all very much for coming out in the rain. And I have way too much to talk about. I'm going to try to give a general sense of what's in the book. But there's much too much for me to cover. So I'd just like to say, buy the book. The proceeds don't go to me. They go right to an Institute for Anarchist Studies. And that goes into funding our ability to fund other people's research projects and things like the Lexicon series that Josh was talking about. And actually, I should let you... He gave such a great intro, I almost feel like he should just kind of give the talk, because that was a really great, in a nutshell, that's what the book is about. But I do want to say, so yeah, get the book if you're curious about things I mentioned but can't go into too much depth on. And check out the other books in the series, too. It's put out by the IAS in collaboration with AK Press. And I'm really excited about the upcoming ones that are coming. The next one coming after mine is called Imperiled Life, and it's about ecology and catastrophe. And then in the pipeline, we have books that are going to be done by No One Is Illegal and Anarchists Against the Wall. And I'm really psyched about those projects. So those will be coming up. So in my remarks, I'm going to sort of echo the structure of the book, which is divided into three interrelated sections, which roughly speaking, we could call the theory, the history, and the praxis sections. And the particular history that informs my theory is that of India's anti-colonial movement, and the questions of praxis that both emerge from and inform my theory and my history are things which relate to the experience of people like us in relation to whatever struggles we're involved in supporting, whether that's Palestine solidarity, whether that's indigenous sovereignty issues, opposing U.S. military interventions, anti-racism work here at home, and all of those things, the engagement with all those issues and my study of history were intersecting in some of the stimuli for my writing this book. So I'll be very happy to answer any questions that you may have about the historical material, but what I'd really like to do tonight is to lead towards, in the last section, to kind of lead towards opening up space for discussion amongst you all on this question of solidarity and how to practice it both ethically and effectively, because for me this issue of solidarity is very closely tied to the question of the relationship between anarchism and anti-colonialism and in my motivation for writing this book. So to start with sort of the theoretical issues that I try to raise here, anarchism and anti-colonialism, for me, have sort of always been these twin political touchstones, which, and for me, they thoroughly inform each other, but what I've found in being involved with different projects and different campaigns is that they're often not thought of in conjunction with each other. They often happen in really separate spaces, or even in sometimes conflicting ways. Yet, what I want to suggest is that thinking about them together creates important interventions in how we think about each one. So what I wanted to do was examine how looking through an anarchist lens changes our understanding of anti-colonialism, while at the same time, looking through an anti-colonial lens changes our understanding of anarchism. So, and for me, this is another thing. This particular conjunction of these two analyses, this conjunction I consider to be sort of the core of a uniquely APOC perspective, and that's a North American tendency of anarchist people of color. And I think that's a really specific thing to that perspective that I've experienced, is where these two analyses link up. So to say a little bit about the first one, and I'll get back to that a little later. So how does looking through an anarchist lens change our understanding of anti-colonialism? And the first key proposition I start with is that anti-colonialism is not the same thing as nationalism, and it's often in kind of the conventional way of approaching anti-colonial struggle equates it to nationalism. And there's a further distinction we could make between nationalism and national liberation that requires making a distinction between the ways we talk about the nation, the state, the nation state, nationalism. And I don't think this is hair splitting. I think this is actually pretty important things to think through. So, if it's not nationalism, then what is it? My understanding of anti-colonialism is that it's actually a much more comprehensive and radical vision of emancipation that unfolds throughout every dimension of a society and involves not only eliminating foreign domination, but restructuring its internal form of organization. So historically, when we look at anti-colonial struggles, people involved in them are always involved in both of these ways. And in a sense, it's much easier to forge a broad kind of coalition. Everyone can agree on, we want to get the external oppressor out. You know, it may not be easy to do, but it's easy to see what that conflict is and to unite around it. It's much more, it's much harder to converge around what your vision of an alternative is. And that, and making the making the link between what things do we need to self-critique that have contributed to our being subject to external forms of oppression. And so it's like these two sides of it always are undergone together. So just, this is a passage from the book. I say, if liberation is to be conceptualized on every level, not just that of political forms, and if the same structures of oppression are not simply to be reopened for business under new local management, which is exactly what many of the dissident and marginalized within a national liberation struggle accuse the mainstream nationalists of doing, and as following formal independence, many rural, peasant, and tribal communities, far left and regional separatist militant groups have accused the Indian centralized government of doing, of simply replicating the exact institutions and forms that the colonial state was using. So if anti-colonial struggle is not to yield a new generation of authoritarian dictatorships and cultural chauvinists, which is the downside of nationalism, the risk that nationalism runs, it's imperative to think through an anarchist logic rather than a nationalist logic of anti-colonial struggle. So here's where I get to a little bit about the distinction between the nation, the state, and nationalism. So what I've found amongst Western anarchist communities is there's sort of a knee-jerk anti-nation sense. And I think the blind spot here is that there's sort of a cultural and a racial blind spot. If it's a primarily North American white-dominated movement, you miss out on some of the sensitivities around which people who have been oppressed as such, as a race, as a nation, may find that to be a very liberatory term and a liberatory identity. So I think it's, I hesitate to tell any, say, an indigenous collectivity who's been oppressed as such that you can't use the concept of nation as an identity of resistance and solidarity or an identification with a territory. But I think in any given case, you have to sort of look at it in every case. You guys are so quiet. if every case, I think it's important to look at where the concept of nation is being used to do emancipatory work and where it's being used to do oppressive work, because it can be used in either of those ways, and it has been. So I think rather than either accepting it or rejecting it categorically, I think we always have to kind of look at who's using it and in what context and to do what. But the problem with nationalism, so nation, I think, is a little more complicated. Nationalism, I would categorically reject, because what that is by definition, nationalism is the idea that any group designated as a nation, and of course we can get into all the complications that arise as far as defining nation, then you have external policing, you have internal homogeneity that has to be enforced, you have, this gets into the control of women's bodies, all of these things which are dangers of nationalism, but that aside, nation, the concept of nation. Nationalism is the idea that any group that we do designate as a nation has to be contained within a territorial state that is exclusive to that group of people and has to put into place all the mechanisms of a state in order to be recognized as legitimate, which means the disciplinary, the military, the revenue extracting mechanisms which define what a state is as a governmental institution. So what I would like is for us to be conceptually able to separate the idea of nation from nationalism, which ties nation to the institution of a state. So one of the things that happens when you look at anti-colonialism this way, we're no longer looking towards the institution of a state to mark the point of freedom, is that the point of formal independence, so when the time when you do kick out the ruler, the regime, is no longer the end point, but it's a transition. It's not the end of the struggle. It's a transition into a new stage of the struggle. So for, in the case of India and Pakistan, this was what happened in 1947. Was that the end of, was that freedom? No, it wasn't. But it was a very important transition. And what this reminds me of now is when we talk about, you know, we just passed the 1 year mark of the Tahrir Square uprising in Cairo, and they got rid of the dictator. Was that the end of the struggle? No, it was the beginning of the struggle, and as we all can see what's going on. So this enables us to see the continuity in time between, when I first started this project and I started to talk to people about it and talk to friends and comrades in India about it, and people would often be like, what are you doing? I thought you were talking about anti-colonial struggle. Why are you asking me about a contemporary social movement about land acquisition in 2012? Why is this an anti-colonial struggle? And so for me, and then as we would talk, we found more often than not we were using different vocabularies to say the same thing, which is part of the thing about anarchism with a big A or a small A. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Removing the achievement of a nation state as the point of freedom enables us much more clearly to see the continuity between the struggles against classical colonial rule and then struggles against neocolonialism, in both the aspect of neoliberal globalized capitalism and in the aspect of projection of militarized police power to enforce it. So it's more of the same. This was always the debate around globalization. Is this a new phenomenon or is this another form of imperialism and colonization? I would argue that it is a new form of colonization. So not only to see the continuities in time, but to see the continuities in space with other communities who are also struggling. And this is a radicalizing and a deepening move for how you see your own struggle. You see it as particularistic, like my people is special and we must be free and those other people can go take care of themselves, versus there's a principle of liberation and it applies to me, it also applies to you, your struggle is my struggle, and our helping each other is also helping in our own cause. And that's exactly what happened in these movements that I'm looking at throughout the, you know, the first half of the 20th century and then beyond into the non-aligned movement. So this, if we're decoupling decolonization from the institution of a nation state and from the identification with a very particular exceptional group, this leads into my second proposition, which is that what I started to see was that the ideas, when you start to flesh out the ideas of what does full decolonization look like on the psychological, the cultural, the social, the economic levels, not just the political form of work, that is important too, but on all these different layers, as it gets fleshed out, it starts to look more and more like an anarchist vision of social transformation, which engages on all these different levels. And so another thing I started noticing, and after noticing that, was that the anarchist tradition in the West, and which I mean sort of the mainline capital A, circle A, TM, historically, contextually specific tradition that we are usually referring to by that particular vocabulary, and the anti-colonial tradition in South Asia, and I suspect in other colonized areas, these conversations are very analogous to each other. And neither is one thing. They both are sort of defined. Both of these kind of intellectual and political discourses over time have been defined by debates around the same questions of how do you balance freedom and equality? How do you balance the individual and the collective? How do you respond to these processes that are associated with modernization, which are the same processes in a lot of cases that are associated with colonization, with some key differences? But the response, it's not just reject, accept. It's much more complicated than that. And rather than identifying either anarchism, because how many times I've heard versions of the debate around, well, what does that even mean? No one agrees on what the definition of it is. Is it modernist? Is it anti-modernist? Is it progressive? Is it anti-civ? These are all parts of the conversation, and I think that we define the tradition by the conversation as a whole, not by any one person's statement within that conversation. And so I see a real analogous spectrum of the kinds of statements within the conversation that people were making within the history of anti-colonial speech and action and the anarchist conversation as we know it. So the processes entailed in colonization are, and the reason for this analogy, just to back up for a second, I think that the reasons for this analogy are because the responses that people are debating are responses to an analogous set of conditions. And those are the conditions that I'm suggesting occur both in the process of some, depending on your context, you call it, this was modernization, this was colonization. So the processes entailed in colonization are recognizable, but as a particularly traumatic and violent acceleration of the frontier of modernization. That's another quote from the book, which is why it sounds more wordy. But here it's externalized, and I don't want to suggest that, because this is another pitfall, there's all these pitfalls, that colonial rule brought modernization to the backward, and that is not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is that in actually existing history as we know it, it's an unavoidable fact that those processes were experienced in the context of this very traumatic external assault. They didn't have to be philosophically, cosmically, but in our history they were. And so that complicates it, because then there's all these sort of cultural and racial knots that have to be untied in these things being associated with each other. So in the first half of the 20th century, this is where I started seeing the analogies again. The traits that differentiated anarchism from other sectors of the left were the same sort of traits that gave it affinities with anti-colonial struggles at the same time. So, for example, the perception of the government itself as an evil, the state being seen as something that's clearly external to society, so that you make your primary targets of resistance the defining mechanisms of state function. So let's say you're going to boycott, sabotage, or raid, or withdraw your cooperation from all of the apparatus, the disciplinary and the ideological. So the police post, you'll attack the police post, you'll attack the armories, the infrastructure, withdraw from law and education systems. So these were all techniques in the anti-colonial struggle. Another implication being that in the colonial context, and this should be familiar to the way, the conversations that occur within anarchist spaces too, in the colonial context, cultural practices, language, education, everyday life, all these things constituted a major dimension of the oppression itself, and therefore a primary field on which resistance played out. So it's not a question of, the more orthodox left would talk about base and superstructure, or differentiating the material and the ideological, but since colonization functioned on these multiple interlocking levels from the structural to the psychological, you have, so it's all at once. Economically, it is textbook accumulation by dispossession. Politically, it is authoritarian state control. Militarily, it is occupation versus counterinsurgency. And then ideologically, it's cultural hegemony. So it's a comprehensive struggle on all these levels at once. And then finally, just to say that the material conditions in which So sort of the standard history of anarchism locates the difference between how the divergence that start happening between, you know, the classic Marx versus Bakunin thing. Classical anarchism was often associated with primary resistance to the onset of industrialization, as opposed to the Marxian or syndicalist assumption that you have to organize revolution from within industrial society. And if you're not there, you have to industrialize first so that you can then organize from industrial society. But for many, in southern and eastern Europe, anarchism was stronger. As for anti-colonialists, because of the way that economies are cemented into the transnational economic structure of colonialism, and this is true of Maoists in India and China as well later, the population, the revolutionary population is dominated by agrarian peasants, not industrial proletarians. That's who is the leading edge of the struggle. That's who is the populist movement. And so it's not just a matter of co-opting an already existing mode of production and just changing its distribution, but challenging its very establishment and then challenging the very structures of thought on which capitalism and modern governmentality are based. So there's all of these different ways in which these conversations unfold analogously because of the historical conditions in which they emerge. But this is where I want to move into a little bit more about how... Oh, and just to say one more thing about... So the question of modernity, this whole backwards-forwards thing, which I like to avoid, this is a question that I talk a lot more about in the book. But what I want to emphasize is that for the people involved in these kinds of conversations, it was not... When there's a critique of modernity as it's being experienced, it's not a reactionary attempt to halt progress, as if the only options are that there's a scripted track, you can either go forward along it or backward along it, but you can, instead, it was, why don't we choose a different, let's not go forward or backward along this track, let's look for a different direction out, a different way forwards that's capable of seeing what are the beneficial aspects of our existing social, cultural fabric, political, economic system. What are the ones we want to keep, and then what are the ones that we would like to transform and improve? So we don't have to go along this line or backward along this line. We can imagine other options outside of it for alternate modernities, counter-modernities, not necessarily anti-modernity. So to move a little bit into how, so that's, you know, that I'm talking about how thinking anarchistically informs how we think about anti-colonialism, to now do the opposite thing. So I've been drawing all these parallels between colonization and modernization in the first section of the book, but there's the very important difference for me is the fact of history, which is that what distinguishes the process of colonization from whatever other instance we want to look at of coercive enclosure of the commons, modernization, accumulation by dispossession, you know, the experience of all the things which are assaultive about this. And that's the dimension of race, which was a key part of what legitimized and masked and carried forth. It was this logic that underlay the project of colonization. And I think it's really unavoidable. And it took various forms. Orientalism is the one that is pertinent here, but there are other forms. And I would like to refer people to an article by Andrea Smith called The Three Pillars of Heteropatriarchy, where she kind of breaks this down. We can't just think about racism in general, but the different logics which manifest in different contexts. But so this is exactly what makes anti-racism such an important component of anti-colonial movement and such an important component of whatever mobilizations we engage in that are in solidarity with anti-colonial movements. And it's exactly where anti-colonial movements or anti-systemic, anti-capitalist, whatever sorts of movements in the decolonizing regions throughout the time period that this is happening, which is, you know, 20th century into the early 21st century, had critiques that were really key for their radical counterparts in the North, in the West. So isolating class struggle did not sufficiently address the fundamental global structures of imperialism or the realities of racism. So this was really an important intervention from the colonial world into those who were fighting against, you know, authoritarian governments or capitalism in the colonizing parts of the world. And it's exactly why anti-racism in the metropolis, to use a colonial era term, is always profoundly interconnected with anti-colonialism in the global South. So, if we foreground colonialism as a primary category of analysis and a primary structure of oppression, and foreground decolonization as central to any kind of emancipatory practice that we want to be involved in. This works in two directions, and this is where I get to the sort of what I've referred to as this kind of APOC perspective, which is uniquely positioned to work in these two directions. And that is to emphasize, with regard to colonized peoples, to emphasize anti-authoritarian and non-nationalist modes of anti-colonial struggle, and at the same time, with regard to hegemonic North American society and countercultural movements who are still in some ways part of it, to emphasize anti-racism. And there's a lot of different aspects of this, and this is why even engaging this kind of theorizing for me is also part of the praxis thing. How do you do solidarity is you think through these things in certain ways, you think through different histories, tell different historical narratives, decolonizing knowledge. So knowing other histories, which is what I wanted to do with the second part of the book, I wanted to sort of talk about a part of the world and how these principles manifest in a part of the world that isn't very well known here, or even there necessarily, because it isn't the standard narrative. So knowing other histories, I think, is an important part of decolonizing knowledge for North American anarchists, let's say, but not claiming other histories. Because that's another tendency that bothers me, which I often see, which is that people will look for resistance movements in other parts of the world and sort of stamp the label on them, even at the risk of misrepresenting them. So it'll be like, yeah, the Zapatistas are anarchists. And they'll be like, oh, no, they're not. And you feel betrayed. It's like, well, I never said they were. And they never wanted to be, you know, approved by you. So just to use one example, I mean, but I often see that there's this tendency to try to look for things and say they're just like you and name them as such, when what you're really seeing are principles of affinity which are valid, and these are traits in common, but which still have to be allowed to be their own thing. And so decolonizing our understanding of our own contextually specific tradition that we call anarchism, you know, Circle A, is one manifestation of a larger family of principles, of egalitarian, emancipatory principles that occur in a lot of different contexts. So it's not like there's a norm and then these things that imitate it, but it's like it's a theme in variations in the horizontal. We are one of the variations, we're not the theme. And I think that's a really important conceptual move of decolonizing the way we think about our theory and our practice. So I want to move a little bit into the middle section of the book. I'm going to see how I'm doing on time. Okay. The middle section of the book is where I propose a different narrative of Indian decolonization. And so it's not that I wanted to force anarchist history onto India, because that doesn't seem appropriate, but rather to see what the history of India looks like from, and why India, you may ask. I am half Indian. I don't know, that always seems like it lets me off the hook for saying, why are you interested in this? Even though that's still a stupid answer. But yeah. So, and this is why I think through these things in strange ways, because I do not identify as a white person, but rather as a light-skinned, mixed-race person, so my thinking is always kind of weird. In good ways, I think. But, yeah. So, I didn't want to try to force an anarchist history onto India and say, these were all the anarchists, I can, like, reveal the hidden anarchists, even though that does sometimes happen, that did sometimes emerge in explicit and self-named ways. But rather, instead of that, to see what happens when you take the way an anarchist thinks and looks at Indian history that way. What are the people and events and ideas and groups that now become visible and legible that were not visible and legible to the standard nationalist narrative? And also, you know, some people who were very visible in the nationalist narrative are now seen in a very different light. So, in fact, some of the canonical figures of Indian nationalism, such as Gandhi and Tagore, who are like icons of the nation, actually have some very anarchistic elements in their own social and political philosophy, for example. But just to really briefly touch on, and this is where I could just, if I talked about all this, I'd talk all night and I'd bore you, and I want you to just buy the book and read it yourself. But just briefly touch on some of the manifestations of these principles that I'm talking about. So the first major one comes in the context of the Swadeshi movement, and that word translates roughly as it's kind of like they themselves compare themselves to Sinn Féin, you know, our own country, and they actually had ties with the Irish Republicans as well, but and with anarchists, Russian anarchist exiles in Paris who were part of the lineage of Bakunin and Nechayev and the People's Will and the people that assassinated the Tsar. They were meeting up with these exiles in Paris, and in more at that time in a sort of they weren't so much like, oh yes, we share your ideas, but you guys are really effective. Can you teach us how you organize? Can you teach us? They wanted to learn to make bombs. Let's face it, this was the height of the propaganda of the deed period. And these are people who we would recognize as, in the way they talk about things, basically they're insurrectionists, because they talk a lot about using this cataclysmic act to wake people up and to jumpstart the struggle and to make the death hear. And so they talk a lot that way. But they became sort of this demonized figure. And again, this is true across the board. The same thing that happened to propaganda by the deed anarchists in the late 19th, early 20th century, they're undergoing sort of the same sort of demonization and kind of generalized labeling as whether you're engaged in national liberation struggle or, you know, whatever sort of internationalist networks. So the next main interface is syndicalism, which happened mainly in the United States and Canadian context. And this, I actually have another book, which is up here if you all want to look at it later. I don't have extra copies, unfortunately, but this book is mainly focused on a movement that emerged called the Gutter Movement, which emerged amongst Indian, and I'm using that term, this is pre-partition, so actually it's people who from the part of the world that is now India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. I could get into a whole thing about terminology there. I'm just saying Indian because it's historically appropriate for this moment. This was a movement that was founded amongst sort of a conglomeration of radical students and intellectuals in Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco, and immigrant laborers who, a lot of them, and these are all, most of them were Sikhs, who had been part of the British Army, because the British Army at the time, at all of the sort of soldiers in the Middle East, in North Africa, in China, who were part of the British Army, were staffed from India, pretty much. And so a lot of these veterans who are now migrant laborers, farm workers, working on railroads and lumber yards along the West Coast in the early 20th century, team up with the radical intellectuals, and they started this militant anti-colonial movement who tried to have a mutiny during World War I. They were getting some German help to overthrow the British, and it was crushed due to informers, and it's a long story, very dramatic, but they're a really important sort of missing link amongst these sort of making these sort of ideological jumps between national liberation and thinking about an international left and getting from one generation of radicalism to the next. One of their main sort of theorists and propagandists, whose name was Hardayal, was really key in kind of popularizing the movement and was the main writer for the newspaper. He was really involved in a lot of the different forms of radicalism at the time that were in the Bay Area. He was the secretary, the secretary of the Oakland branch of the IWW. He worked a lot with, what's his first name? Owen, who worked with the Magone brothers a lot. So there's all these ties between the PLM and the IWW and the Gutter Movement. He started something called the Bakunin Institute, which is why he tried to sort of be like, found, you know, someone donated him a piece of land, and he tried to have this sort of kind of monastic training center for radicals, which was like the Order of the Red Flag, and he did a lot of things where he sort of was part of these intersecting worlds of anarchism and radicalism and syndicalism in the Bay Area, and then the Indian anti-colonial struggle. So he's just one figure, he's not the only one, but he was sort of the one that became known as the person that was connecting all the dots between these two things. So that's a pretty interesting moment. That's what a lot of this book is about. Then we have World War I and the Russian Revolution have a huge effect on the way, you know, the Indian movement is playing out, just as it did on global radicalism across the board at the time, where it starts to take up all this space. And a lot of these other kind of more free-ranging forms of radicalism that were present before the war, sort of everything kind of falls into this overdetermined form, because it was seen as very, very exciting and very inspiring, except that they were all at the same time critics on the left who were not containable within the party orthodoxy, and were committed to revolutionary anti-capitalism and anti-imperialism, but could not refrain from critiquing what they saw as this kind of increasing authoritarianism. And so if there's one person that I'd most like to see rescued from obscurity that I talk about, this is one of the people who was in that context. MPT Acharya was part of he was involved with the gutter movement, he was involved with some of these, he was also involved with the kind of insurrectionists in Paris and London that I first mentioned. He sort of spanned the whole thing in his own political career. He took part in some of the German-sponsored missions to try to propagandize to the soldiers, as I said, these Indian soldiers who were part of the British Army in Egypt, in what they then called Mesopotamia, we call it Iraq. So he's involved in kind of the whole trajectory of how the movement unfolds. Then after the war, so he ended up in Stockholm. They kind of, like, as Germany's losing, all the people that were based in Germany kind of had to move on. So he ends up in Stockholm and is one of the people who's putting out this next round of political writings on behalf of Indian independence. And there's a sort of a British mouthpiece. It's another Indian, but he's the guy who the British are paying to kind of, like, discredit the liberation speakers. And he's saying, these writings on behalf of independence are, they don't mean anything, he doesn't speak for any of us, don't listen to this guy, he's just an anarchist. And his logic was, plainly, the British colonial government is the epitome of modern governance, and it's wonderful, and it's efficient, and it's beneficial, and anyone who would object to it has to be against all governance, because this is the epitome of governance, so he must be an anarchist. But in his case, he claimed it. So he and his sort of partner in crime, Chattopadhyay, he's a whole other story. I'm not going to talk about him right now. But so they put out this statement which said, if it is anarchism to be thoroughly ashamed of being ruled by a handful of vile alien vandals, if it is anarchism to wish to exterminate them with the noble desire of establishing our national freedom upon the basis of popular sovereignty, justice, mercy, righteousness, and humanity, if it is anarchism to rise for the sanctity of our homes, the integrity of our life, and then keeping in mind the context here, and the honor of God on our country, and to slay every individual tyrant, whether foreign or native, that continues the enslavement of a great and noble people, if that is anarchism to conspire ceaselessly, again context, to take human life with the only object of emancipating our beloved motherland, then we say cursed is the man that is not an anarchist. And he actually did then. So he went to Moscow then, he makes friends with Lenin, he gets sent to Kabul where he makes contact with the Provisional Government of India in exile, that they go on to Tashkent, so all of they're moving through Central Asia, and this is very complicated networks, again, that's in this book. They establish sort of what's the precursor to the Communist Party of India, which is called the Indian Revolutionary Association, or Inqilab-e Hind, and so all the time there's sort of this again is like this pattern goes for pretty much every part of the decolonizing world at this time, not just for India. So they're starting their own groups and they're going back to Moscow and they're trying to get official recognition from the Communist International. And so there's this kind of fight amongst the Indians overseas of who's going to be the one that's going to get the official mark of approval. He was always on the wrong side because he had these anti-authoritarian leanings. He was very critical of kind of what he saw happening. And so he ended up being on the outs. Went back to Europe and declared himself an anarcho-syndicalist, which his friends saw. He's reverting to his former ways. He's an anarcho-syndicalist, so he always had these tendencies. So there he's keeping in touch with trade union activity in Madras, which is where he was from, in South India. He's supplying information about, so kind of news briefs about the Indian labor movement to a Russian anarcho-syndicalist paper, and he's kind of serving as a communication hub for a lot of this. And then he keeps trying to get back to India, but he can't because they keep threatening him with arrest as soon as he arrives. Finally, he gets back in 1935, along with, he's now married a woman who is a Russian artist, so they arrive in 1935. And he lives in Bombay as a journalist until he dies in 1954. So at the time, so he's serving as kind of a mentor and a theoretical guide to the Libertarian Socialist Institute in Bombay, and this is something that most people haven't even heard of. Like, it's very obscure. But he's working out a pretty well-theorized way of thinking through libertarian socialism, which, if you know Noam Chomsky or Daniel Gauran, that's their definition of anarchism. and he's writing articles. But by the time he died, he was kind of destitute and forgotten. And one of his editors at one of his papers wrote, in tribute to him, "Acharya was a total believer in the doctrine of philosophical anarchism. He believed in the message of Gandhiji's nonviolence and Sarvodaya. This belief he'd come to hold as a result of his long and arduous campaigning in foreign lands for the cause of India's freedom. He stood for a free and decentralized social order based on complete liberty, equality, and dignity of true human personality." So he's kind of an obscure figure who, if you're not looking at things this way, you would completely dismiss him. But if you are, he stands out as a pretty important person. The, you know, sort of the opposite of him, it would be someone like Bhagat Singh, who is a big hero of mine, as he is for a gajillion other people, but not all for the same reason. So he's been claimed from everybody from Sikh nationalists to the sectarian Marxist-Leninist parties. And he was an anarchist. I make the argument in the book. I can sense that I'm taking up too much time on this, but the case that they make for, oh, he was a Marxist-Leninist, was that he was, so he was a guy who was extremely brilliant. He died at age 23. He was executed after taking part in some militant actions. So he wrote a lot of his stuff while he was in jail, and he had these jail notebooks where he's working through all these questions about how do you balance liberty and equality, what's the meaning of justice and law. He had written several articles about the history of anarchism, and he was kind of characterized by his contemporaries as the Bakuninites. But the case that they make, they're like, he saw the light at the end. He was reading Lenin's biography. He'd gone over to Marxist-Leninism when he died at the time that he was hanged, and he put out these statements in favor of it. But if you read through a lot of his readings, he sort of synthesized everything, and he had this huge range of things that he was reading, and he would sort of like think through it and incorporate it into his own way of thinking. And I have no way of knowing, of course, but I think that if he had lived longer, he would have incorporated what he was reading in terms of Marxist-Leninist thought on the economy and all this stuff, and critiqued it and synthesized it with his other readings and come to, I like to think, maybe rather than thinking that communism recuperated him, that, who knows, he might have recuperated communism and come up with a less authoritarian and centralized form of that. So there's a lot more in here. I go through into Tagore and Gandhi, as I mentioned. I go into sort of their social vision of the which got marginalized in the course of the independence struggle, but kind of fleshed out this whole idea of a decentralized federation of autonomous Kropotkinite villages, more or less. And then I go into some of the... let me just skip ahead, though, because this, I don't want to get bogged down in a lot of the details, and I wish I could talk all night about it, but I don't want to bore you. But I wanted to highlight some of the recent and current movements in which we see the principles of anti-authoritarianism, decentralization, intersectionality, which are also starting to balance concerns about development with ecological awareness. And that itself is a critique of the kind of party-based left that this is responding to. Because in India, the sort of the organized party, Marxist-Leninist left, has remained relatively strong. So just as it sort of, that took up the space and anarchism in its kind of classical form was seen to retreat when with the rise of Marxism-Leninism in the 20s, as it retreated, then when people talk about the emergence of the new left and the newer social movements, and now more anarchistic elements have emerged into kind of the evolution of I don't know, whatever you want to call it, progressive left thought. In India, the left parties have remained relatively strong. They're still a major force in electoral politics, in guerrilla struggle. Like, they're going strong. And I think, I personally think that's one of the reasons why the vocabulary of anarchism has remained less prominent. But there's been all along this sort of critical counter-left, which does not use the language of anarchism, but is making a lot of the same critiques of the party-based left that any of you who have heard the similar conversations in our context would recognize. So we see amongst these movements an intense opposition to the state as an inherently repressive force, and this is relatively new, because I think in the decades following independence, it was sort of generally accepted, like, the state was seen as, it still kind of had this aura of, this was the bearer of freedom from imperial rule, and now it's a leader in kind of non-alignment and anti-imperialism, it's resistance. And later on, since well, since the 1970s, but particularly since neoliberalization of the economy and sort of the rise of the Hindu right in the 90s, now it's kind of seen as, oh, the state is actually not our friend, and it's not an emancipatory force. This is becoming more generally accepted. It's an inherently repressive force, and we cannot ask for it. We can't petition it for it. So this kind of thinking is becoming, I think, a lot more prevalent amongst social movements. And in recent years, one of the ones I wanted to highlight was that the issue of land acquisition is one of the most urgent and salient sites at which you can see resistance to both at the same time, to neoliberal capitalism and to the Indian state, which is seen as its agent. So there's this a legal instrument which was put into place in colonial period, which is 1894 Land Acquisition Act, which was put into place by the British administration, and the same act, unchanged, is what's being used to seize land that's collectively occupied by a village, for example, and give it to a corporation or to a mining company for use as a special economic zone. And so in the past few years, some of the major movements and the major sort of coalitions of resistance, both nationally and international, that have gained a lot of international support, have been based on resistance to land acquisition for the special economic zones. And again, in this final chapter, I don't want to go into all these details right now, but these sorts of mobilizations, you have farmer mobilizations, you have tribal mobilizations, all of these things are beginning to intersect. And as well, just as in the early 20th century, you started to see these points of contact with kind of international radical networks, which were suffused with the classical anarchist ideas, this starts to intersect in the late 20th and early 21st century with this, I think, analogous kinds of international networks which were associated with the alter-globalization or anti-globalization movement, or with the World Social Forum movement, or with the, all these different sorts of kind of intersections where it's not that they're necessarily, oh, so now everyone's an anarchist, that's not what I'm saying, but that these sorts of ideas are kind of like circulating amongst the mix and affecting how things get thought about and talked about. So, again, I feel like I could just go into all the details, but instead of that, what I'd really like to do is use that as a segue into us here and now and what this has to do with us. So when I write about historical actors, I find that I tend to write about people who were asking similar questions to the ones that I'm concerned with. So I don't expect them to find the same answers because they're in a different context, but I do see a pattern in myself that I tend to look at people who are asking similar questions. So I often find myself asking, and I also find myself getting like really excited about the people, and I like kind of like I love them and I wanna like don't wanna let them down. So I find myself asking, if they were here now, what would they be doing? As sort of like, what should I do? What would they do? And their own record, I think, shows pretty clearly that they would be trying to support whatever struggles they could see anywhere in the world that are resisting capitalism or imperialism or any form of injustice, exploitation, oppression. It sounds really generalized, but I think that was, they would say those things straight out, like no one is free until everyone is free. Slavery anywhere means that we have not yet cast off our own slavery. They supported political prisoners because a lot of them ended up as political prisoners. They supported anti-deportation, immigrants' rights struggles, because again, that was them as well. But they generalized it. They moved it beyond just their own special case. They tied India's liberation to the liberation of Egypt, Ireland, and China. You know, those were just the major ones. They saw themselves as part of, once we get into kind of fascism starts to arise, they start to see their own anti-imperial struggle as one front in the popular front against fascism. They link themselves, I have to get this one quote, which I love, because, so they started to link themselves. So this is a quote that comes from a book by a member of the Progressive Writers Movement, and they were a group of writers who were leftists, and they were students in London, and started to make these sorts of connections. So this is a memoir by one of them who's talking about, this is from a book called Lucknow Ki Panchrate, which is Five Nights in Lucknow. And he's talking about a night when some of the key figures who include names who are like major literary figures later, if you'd recognize them from Urdu literature, they're all kind of hanging out, and they're these young poets, and they're like hanging out and drinking and sharing poetry and like ranting about politics and having a great time. And there's a picture above the fireplace. It's like this stormy winter night, and they've just come from a mushaira, which is like a political poetry gathering. I think the closest thing I could compare it to would be like a political poetry slam, when they come from that and they're all fired up. And so there's this picture above the fireplace of one of mujeres, of the Mujeres Libres from the Spanish. This is in the 1930s, so it's all going on then. And they said, so he says, he describes the picture, and he describes it in very ardent terms, and he describes, like, look at her. It's very sexist, but anyway, they had some work to do. And he says, in a way, this picture was a translation of our romantic and our revolutionary emotions. We too wanted to be warriors unto death, because it said to death under the picture. We too wanted to be warriors unto death. We considered Spain to be our own country because it was fighting against fascism for freedom and the beautiful dreams of humanity. Spain's freedom was our freedom, and on this night, the warrior woman was included in our party in advancing our courage in the intoxication of India's freedom. And so then one of them, who later ended up in Lebanon, offers a poem, and then they all start trading poems, and he says, this music was a new signal bell, and Fez, if you know this poetry, this is like one of the most important revolutionary poets, that's the guy who's talking about. This music was a new signal bell in Fez's soul, which in his later life would bring him to the tents of the Palestinian Mujahideen. This warrior woman of Spain and Yasser Arafat of Palestine are two names for the same united front, as is our own struggle against imperialism in India. So, regardless of all of the nuances of the differences between these different ideologies and these different struggles, they're seeing themselves as this is all part of this great freedom struggle. And then he segues into a story about a Ku Klux Klan riot and where Paul Robeson was singing. And so he's making all these crazy links, and it's just kind of, I just get a big kick out of it because he's so excited about freedom in all its forms. So I kind of started this section with that just to show that to distill the conversations and debates that I feel like I've been involved in these conversations and debates over so many years, and I sort of broke them all down into an imaginary Q&A out of all of the Qs that I've been faced with many, many, many times. And these are all the questions about debating whether to be in solidarity with national liberation struggle and how to be in solidarity, and then, you know, how do you do this without replicating colonial behavior? How do you do this without violating your own principles? How do you do this and actually do something that's helpful? And so some of the key questions, and rather than kind of go through and tell you what my answers were, I really wanted to throw out these questions and kind of use this as a way to start discussion. Some of the key questions being just how can someone who claims to be an anarchist support national liberation struggle if that is about a demand for a state? How do you support or work in coalition with people who may have opinions and ideals you can't accept, such as assumptions about religion or gender? How do you deal with the imbalance in power and privilege and wealth that occur between someone who's a relatively mobile activist from the global north and people struggling against oppression in the global south? And then what do you do to act in solidarity? What are the sites of resistance that are most appropriate for you to tackle from your specific location? And here I'll just say one thing about that, which is that in one sense, it's relatively simple to see solidarity as the expression of support, whether symbolic or material, for a resistance movement. But I think an even deeper way of thinking about it is that to recognize our interrelationship, our systemic, our structural, our historical interrelationship. And so if it's about should you go be a savior by taking up someone else's struggle, or should you say, you know, you're in the belly of the beast, maybe the best way to help is to try to bring down the empire that you're implicated in. And that's actually something that was suggested to me one time on an ISM trip to the West Bank. And someone was like, we're really glad you're here. We so appreciate everyone coming here. But you know what? What the best thing you can do is you are in the U.S., go bring down the U.S. empire. So if we recognize colonialism as an interconnected power, global power system in which we're all differentially located, then we, you know, as they said in this kind of like post-poetry intoxication evening, we are all a part of this multi-front battle to dismantle and replace that global system. And so then the key is to figure out where we are and what we do from where we are, but then the key being to link them up, not just kind of mentally, but concretely to link them up with each other. And so I guess here, before I just throw this out, I would really love to hear your thoughts on all of these questions of solidarity, but just to give a couple of plugs about things that I'm involved with that are trying to do some sorts of things like this. So one thing, aside from New York City APOC, shout out, the other kind of major influence on my thinking in the process of writing this was a group that I'm also involved in here called South Asia Solidarity Initiative. And they have, among other things, they are connected to something called the People's Mining Zone Solidarity Group, which is involved with solidarity around some of these land acquisition issues that I was talking about. The webpage is southasianinitiative.org. But we're also doing a six-week course at the Brecht Forum called Beyond Boundaries, Building Solidarities, which is supposed to enable exactly this kind of cross-border solidarities between activists in New York City and progressive social movements in South Asia by giving historical context for current events and kind of bring a primer for contemporary South Asian politics. And that's happening on Sundays from 4 to 6, starting on March 4th, and it's on the Brecht Forum website. There's more information about how to register for that. Adela New York is another thing I'm involved with. There's tons of stuff coming up, doing boycott, divestment, sanctions against, y'all, sure you have heard of it, against Israeli occupation of West Bank and Gaza. Tons of stuff coming up that they're working on, so check out that website. It's adelany.org, A-D-A-L-A-H-N-Y.org. And then finally, I want to give another shout-out. Another place where I'm seeing this kind of stuff manifest in practice is the OWS Global Justice Working Group, which is going to be, tabling this Sunday at Tompkins Square Park. And we also have there's a committee that is part of this working group, which has been working on U.S.-based tear gas manufacturers who profit from the suppression of democracy in all the different, so in the Arab Spring uprisings and the Occupy uprisings, and is trying to make just this sort of link. So, do we have a website? Blog?
We're on the NYCGA website.
Okay.
And we're also, you can find us on Facebook.
Okay, find us on Facebook. I hate Facebook. Find us on the NYCGA website.
Yeah, we're on the NYCGA website. I don't know the name of our blog right now, but it's there.
It's a global justice working group.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to shut up because I always talk too long.
Yeah, but you have, before you shut up, you have to mention Monday starts Israeli apartheid.
Monday starts Israeli apartheid week. Yeah, is there like a clearinghouse website where people can see the different events laid out?
Yes, you Google. I know we hate Google too, but just Google Israeli apartheid week, and then each of the cities has a link, including New York.
Yeah, what Gene said. Okay, so I just want to throw this open, and like I said, I'm happy to answer specific questions about some of the stuff I've mentioned, but I'm really more interested in hearing the sorts of thoughts that you have about solidarity, about anarchism, anti-colonialism, whatever other thoughts you have. Thanks.
Can I tell a quick 2-10 story? Has anyone here seen
You might help to turn so people in the back.
Oh yeah. Right. Anyone here seen the Pinochet case, the movie? The Pinochet case? There's a really great story from that. One of the prosecutors in Spain who brought the indictment against was Pinochet in their court system. He was interviewed in the film. He was asked why, you know, what motivated him to do this. And the story he told was of one of the first countries that sent ships to evacuate refugees from Franco, from the bombings in Spain, was Chile, under the direction of a very young Minister of Health, Salvador Allende. And that sort of, it reverberated. So it was like that. That's one of the things about the solidarity that I think of is how it reverberates, and it's a feedback loop, and you can sort of build on it that way.
I don't want to divert. Anarchists were left off of those ships. That was also directed by Pablo Neruda, who was a Marxist fellow traveler. And CNT people had a hard time getting to Chile.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I had a question about how do you approach anti-colonial nationalist struggles over history, coming from an anarchist framework, and these are just some questions that I've been grappling with lately, like as an anarchist or someone who hears for those politics dealing with anti-colonial nationalist politics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things is simply to look more deeply into the struggle because they're never monolithic. They're never monolocal. And I think it's easy for us to just accept the dominant voice because it's easily institutionalized and it's granted legitimacy by the way these things are usually talked about, is, you know, the elite nationalist voice, but it's never the only one that's there. There's always, I mean, I think it's fair to say there's probably always other progressive voices who are internally critical within that struggle and have a more radical vision, a more comprehensively emancipatory vision. And I think looking for those people, you will find them. I mean, I think in any anti-colonial struggle, if you look for who is talking this way, who is trying to connect this in a deeper way, and someone is going to be thinking about anti-colonialism on their own behalf in ways that transcend and go beyond this kind of standard nationalist narrative. And, you know, find them, hook up with them. That's what I've tried to do for myself to approach it.
So following Chris Hedges' smear piece, right, there was a good deal of sort of, I guess you could call it anarchist baiting, right, that was going on. It fortunately didn't last terribly long. But in that window in which there was a good bit of sort of demonization of anarchists within the Occupy movement and whatnot, people, I guess, expectedly got some anxiety about that and got worried that they were going to start to be targeted and marginalized within the movement. And I was watching the live tweets of the Spokes Council here in New York one night, and I don't know who they were, but there were anarchists who actually went to the Spokes Council and tried to get an anarchist caucus established within the Spokes Council because they felt like they were a targeted group that needed to sort of self-organize and whatever. And quite rightly, I think, quite correctly, the POC caucus and the queer caucus and the women's caucus and stuff were quite incensed and insulted by this because they felt like it was an appropriation of a marginality that wasn't actually quite so material for these people. And the people proposing it didn't seem to get that, and didn't seem to get that why that would outrage people, why that would insult people. And it seemed to me that there would be something deeply anti-authoritarian about not colonizing that vocabulary, not colonizing that framework of analysis. And I guess I kind of wanted to put that out there and sort of pitch to you, maybe, what do you think a reformulation of anarchist subjectivity or anarchist ethics along those lines might look like? What would the terms of that be?
Yeah, and I think just as earlier I was saying, I think we have to look in each context, in each specific situation, whether the concept of nation is being used in a liberatory or an oppressive way. I think it's the same with the way people are using the terminology of anarchism. Because I go back and forth on, and I've had this argument many times too, and I don't know that I follow one side or the other, but just like the idea, so do you, given that we all know those words have a lot of associations for people which many times are negative, and often they are based on a real experience which was quite negative, and it should be called out for some people using it for some bad stuff. So do you try to reclaim the words and say, actually, no, this is what that word means to me. This is the principles under which I'm using, this is my referent for that language. Or do you kind of just abandon it and say, the words are really not that important. I am more concerned with the principles that are important to me and that I'm really committed to, and maybe other people call them other things. And if the word is going to alienate people from these principles and from connecting around those principles, then maybe we don't need the word. The substance is more important than the label. And yet, you know, we do feel, at the same time, you know, I still do feel enough of a loyalty to what my ideal is of that tradition that I'm not willing to totally give up on the word, but I'm also not so tied to it that I'm going to insist on using it in a place where it's not useful or where it's counterproductive. So, but I think that's something we all have to ask is, like, what are the associations that people have with those words? Because sometimes the associations of those people that people have with those words are based on real experience of people that were, you know, really misbehaving and being stupid and oppressive. I don't know if that answers the question, but I think it is something that it's something that needs to be, you know, faced.
So I moved here to the U.S. of, like, 20 years ago, and I grew up in Punjab, and out of a very, like, anti-statist Punjabi tradition. Like, we have a photo of We had a photo of Bhagat Singh in our house going up, and then like everyone on our block and everyone in the city that I'm from has a photo of Binderwal, who is the Sikh separatist. And it was really interesting to come to the States and not having any idea about black liberation struggles or about civil rights struggles, and finding this sort of like really beautiful interconnectivity between the two. Like how pretty much like, I guess something like Malcolm X going to Mecca, and I'm also thinking about Martin Luther King's trip to India. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. And then it was really cool also to think about like how Gandhi started off a lot of his struggles in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
but then how South Africa was also watching what was happening in the U.S. in the 60s and as a framework for their own apartheid struggles. Super cool stuff.
Like on that kick, what do you think are the movements that North American anarchists should be paying the most attention to right now? They might not really.
What do you all think? I mean, I'm not the.
You went to India.
You're the one at the front.
We didn't hear the question.
What movements that are now in the world do I or any of you think that North American anarchists should consider the most significant? What was the word most?
Things that can take instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Like my other, another question I have is, what are the main differences you see between like North people from North America and anarchists and anti-authoritarians in the global South and around the world who don't come from the empire?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that are visible, which are obvious, that here have to be argued about, and I mean, simply just talking about cultural hegemony and race, you know, that's like, duh, that's part of common sense. Or I think even what I notice in Indian political, like mainstream political discourse, is the equivalent of pretty farther to the right, is a greater understanding of imperialism as a global structure. You know, it's like whether you like it or don't like it, it's recognized as something that makes sense, that it's pretty, it's logical. It's not something that has to be controversially argued over whether it exists and whether we can call it that. I mean, I guess there's a lot going on in a lot of parts of the world, and I hesitate to say one's more important than the other. But I do think that, I mean, I guess there's a couple different factors that are interesting to look at, and like, it's like, well, for one thing, where do you see people with whom you feel affinity is one thing, but where do you, then, you know, just to be crude, to put it crudely, where do you see struggles which are linchpins of a really oppressive global system in which, say, maybe intervening is more directly strategic? So it's like, you can't quantify oppression, you can't quantify righteousness of a cause, because I mean, if you have a principle of justice and equality, like every instance of it is as valid as any other. But I think this is a question of I think this goes back to the thing about what's your situation, where are you situated, like what can you do from where you are? I mean, anyone else has thoughts on this? Please. Over here, and then
Carlos. Yeah, sure. I like the way you put it, and something I've been playing with a lot in my head, but out of my head, and more in my actions, is that sense of, as an individual, you know, when we talk of the context, but really honing that to my individual experience in this path I'm walking through life, and thinking where that affinity has pulled me to, but also, like, that's only half of the opportunity for things that I can do that need to get done. The other half is very uncomfortable space, but very important space to explore, too, and not just word-wise, and not just among the like-minded, but something where, being the white guy, I can go kind of like walk along the wall and hear those things that don't get said straight to those oppressed people. And not just to carry the message, but to carry myself through that space when it needs to be done openly, even though it's very uncomfortable and difficult to do. But never too much of just that, because it taxes the system tremendously to take some of that, but then to also move to those affinities and to sort of recharge. And yeah, the way you're talking of sort of taking stock, I feel that is a very personal sort of assessment. We're putting these titles to it and working for movements and the sense of the anarchists or collectives of lefts and rights and the rest of it, but just that the sense of an individual I've been using a lot.
So I don't know if this isn't so external to the States, well the first chunk of it isn't, but I do think that there ought to be, we should think about ways for those of us who identify with anarchism as a political tradition to seriously engage, in part through getting to know some of this history, that like very large chunk of people kind of identify with the Gandhian tradition in the like United States activist scene, because it's been like superficially really influential, and often there's a whole reserve of other like community building and self-rule, self-sufficiency stuff that's going on with Gandhism in India that isn't necessarily brought into that conversation. And I feel like, especially because those people can often be people that have a really frustrating conversation with anarchists all the time, there's a bunch of other interesting conversations that we have. But my other question is, I think, a little more messy. And it has to do with how do you... I think that this equation of anarchism and with anti-colonialism, or they're like putting them as like an offspring of the same impulse, raises this other question that's about what happens after anti-colonialism and how, you know, James Scott did this anarchist history of Southeast Asia, and one of the things that he notes is that every society, all kinds of different governments have managed to like proceed in the kind of same direction around the environment and incorporation of indigenous peoples as state subjects. And I think it's easy for anarchists to make that reading and say, oh, well, we're against the state, so we won't do that. But he points out that all these very, very different political movements kind of ended up having the same effect in this region on indigenous peoples. And I think that those of us who do indigenous solidarity work, whether it's domestically in the U.S. or internationally, are often now confronting fairly progressive governments, some of which are tied to exactly those social movements that we had a great deal of affinity with. And I think that we really need to refine our vocabulary, trying to figure out how much of that is statism, is like running the state, how much of it is capitalism, how much of it is a kind of ideal of modernization that is opposed to indigenous autonomy and independence, how much of it is like internalized racism, how much of it is ideas about like, oh, we should go settle these spaces that aren't legible to us. Like, how do all those different things play out? Because I think that we'll find more things to question about ourselves that rather than just questioning about the state to which we are put.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really important, like, all the themes you just listed are, like, really important in the kind of conversations that I think do develop in the anti-colonial context, and one of the key terms is developmentalism, which, I mean, that's something that doesn't, that's, I think, one of the differences that someone asked about, is, like, we don't usually, it's not a key term that relates to the experience of people in the global north now, because that all happened a long time ago. But the whole idea of what is development and what does it do and is it good and is this something, is it progress, is it modernization, is it resource extraction that facilitates the accumulation of capital for someone somewhere that isn't you? You know, what is, so there's this whole idea that, oh, we have to develop the third world. And the whole logic of that, I think, questioning what that actually means and who is using that terminology to refer to what kind of process is one of the major issues for it, it's yet another vocabulary for kind of talking about these. I lost my train of thought, but
I was curious if you could say a little bit about like national liberation struggles that actually did have capital A anarchists involved, like, you know, Cuba and the Philippines come to mind, but I'm sure there are others. You know, because in the Indian context, like, you make an argument that you know, lowercase a anarchists were extremely involved in that struggle, but it seems as though, you know, it would be a mistake to assume that anarchism and anti-colonialism are separate strands that need to be brought together by analysis, because in fact, you know, there you can find numerous examples where the two were you know, very much working together from the start in a very explicit way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, even since, so all of this kind of stuff is going along a similar timeline. So, like, we're talking about specific cases kind of from the late 19th, early 20th century up to, like, the middle of the 20th century. And yeah, I mean, I think capital A anarchists, I didn't mean to imply that there weren't any involved, because they were. And that means both people, and I think this is true of people in the UK in relation to India. This is true of people in France in relation to Algeria. Then in all of these cases that there's connections being made between people in the colonized area who are in some cases explicitly identifying with the vocabulary, and other times maybe, you know, it's in both ways, the small A and the big A, but making connections with, so French anarchists are finding it part of their political belief requires that they fight against French colonial rule in Algeria, and to some extent, not as much I think, but to some extent that's also the case in the UK with saying, like, if we believe in what we're saying, we have to oppose, you know, colonial rule of India. And I almost feel like there was less conflict at that time with people. I don't think people got as hung up about saying, oh, we can't support a national liberation struggle. It was like, we're fighting for self-determination. We're fighting against oppression. What's to argue with about that? And then people use language that in you know, to an ear now sometimes sounds kind of contradictory. But like, so even before that, even like within Europe, like the Pan-Slavic movement, so all of the different kind of nationalities that were part of the Tsarist Empire, or, you know, parts of the Spanish, so yeah, as you said, the Cuba and the Philippines, like, I don't hear the same kind of hang up about, oh, but we can't support a national struggle. I think it was more just assumed, like, we're fighting for social revolution and internationalism, not for, you know, the particularist nation. So it's like, jump into the struggle and try to build social transformation in every way. Like, don't let the struggle be ruled by the bourgeoisie.
Doesn't nationalism sour at a certain point in the 20th century? Like, I mean, Bakunin himself was a Pan-Slavist, right?
Yeah.
And was a nationalist,
yeah,
in some ways. Yeah, he's one of the fathers of anarchy. But then, like, after 45, you know, when you have the whole regime of post-colonial states that are starting to form, and the elites that are, like, you know, creating their power, and then in Africa where you have, like, all the new ethnicities where you have, you know, the cycle that leads to, like, later ethnic cleansings, you know, throughout the 70s, you know, and then doesn't that sour nationalism?
Yeah, but that's exactly...
Where you had black nationalists here who were defending all kinds of people in Africa who, you know, and the 60s might have been just, you know, revolutionaries, but then went on to take part in ethnic cleansings and...
Yeah, I know, and you could think of tons of examples of that, like, you know, you could think of Mugabe, you can think of Gaddafi, you can think of tons of people who were seen as, like, liberation heroes, and then authoritarian dictators who the people hate and want to overthrow. But, I mean, I think that, I mean, that's one thing. That's a person who takes power and becomes evil, as power does. But I think aside from that, that's the argument that nationalism is the wrong way to go, because nationalism is going to lead that way, because nationalism demands that you set up a state, and that means you have to set up certain kinds of institutions which do those things. So that's exactly why I think it's important to be like, well, can we conceptualize an idea of national liberation which is non-statist, which is anti-authoritarian? Because then you can see, like, this is a group of people that's been oppressed by colonial rule. We want liberation, but we have to think about what liberation looks like and what it means and what kind of society, what kind of governmental structure, you know, what kind of economy, all these things you want. And I think that's exactly where you need an imaginary that's non-statist, precisely in order to avoid that. Because it's not, I think, so much that, oh, we thought nationalism was good and then it soured. It's like, we think anti-colonialism is good and it got taken over by nationalism. And that's where I think it's like, we need an anti-colonialism, an alternate anti-colonialism.
It's like the system of states are kind of another phase of imperialism.
Yeah, and people made that exact point. So the thing is, like, to think about decolonization as a process, not as one single moment. So it's not like, oh, the foreigners left and they handed over the flag and they handed over, you know, the institutions into local, you know, it's like we sold the store, now the you know, it has local ownership now, but it's still under, maybe has another name, but it works the same way. So rather than... That's the thing. So decolonization didn't mean the moment of the handover of the existing institution from one hand to the other. Like, decolonization is an ongoing process of trying to take apart that institution and replace it with something. So decolonization, if you think about it, this is an ongoing project of greater and greater emancipation. In that sense, it's not over. And there's people who never stopped fighting it, regardless of... That's why I talked about it. It's not that that was the end of the struggle, but a transition, a new stage in the struggle. And it adds different complications because it's harder. It's easy when you say, you know, get out that foreigner. It's easy to get people to agree around that. When you say, look, yeah, we can't use the national... You can't demonize this person on national grounds anymore because this is, you know, this is us too. So now you have to name it. You have to kind of like take another step and name it for what it is. It's not bad because it's foreign. And this is where you get the, I think, the nationalist split as well. When you say, this was bad because it's foreign, but as long as we control it, it would be okay. And the non-nationalist view would say, was like, no, this is bad. We don't want this. I don't care who, I don't care if it's us or them who's running it. I don't want this thing. So decolonization continues. And, you know, but it's trickier because you no longer have that kind of rallying point of the clear enemy.
I wonder if I'm correct in feeling like you're, when you talk about capital A anarchism, I felt like the emphasis was kind of on U.S. anarchism. And I kind of feel like the historically most weighty manifestation of capital A anarchism is Spain and Latin America. Which becomes very interesting as far as colonization, because you have people who are first colonizers and then colonized, and then a lot of different indigenous variants that are capital A anarchism.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Zapatistas.
Yeah. No, I mean, a couple of things. Like, I think I'm not necessarily talking about the U.S. I think I'm talking about a tradition which emerged at a particular moment in European history, but that is the reference point for... people that identify with anarchism here in the kind of the assumed referent for it. So I'm kind of talking about the classical history and movements now that connect themselves to that kind of history. But I think that the distinction between... So yeah, like a lot of the... there's like Italian and Spanish dissidents who were really important in the spread of these ideas within the realms of what would have been the Spanish Empire, so in Latin America. But that's, I think, where there's an important distinction between the ruling powers of a country and the dissidents of that country. And it's in the dissidents of a country that I think some of the most exciting resistance has come about, when the dissidents of a country and the external opponents of that country see themselves as allies. And I think that's what happened in a lot of these cases. So it's not that they're being defined by their country affiliation, but, you know, the external and the internal critiques join up against the regime. Yeah.
Getting back to this question of supporting like nationalist movements, where if you're an anarchist, you don't believe in it. What about something like a critical support? Like, you can support it in certain ways, but still be critical of them if they commit it.
I think that's really important, and I think the way to do that, I think support has to be critical support. But in order to be critical, you have to establish a basis of equality, because you have to be then subject to criticism yourself as well, and the criticism has to be mutual. So I think then that's just like, how do you go into a situation in which you're not set up as kind of above in the power gradient? So it can't be a passive and an active, it can't be a helper and a helped, it has to be like, this is a mutually beneficial partnership, when we may recognize that we're not the same in terms of the resources that we have available, or the restrictions that we're subject to, you know, there's a lot of important power differences, but if you approach things in a way that is based on mutual respect and it's a horizontal two-way relationship, I think that's the only way to achieve critical support, which is the only really healthy support that there is. I think that's really important. I'm glad that you brought that up. There's another good book that reminds me of, which is Wobblies and Zapatistas, which is sort of the dialogue between Stalin and Andrei Gorbachev. So that's another one that I would recommend. Well, thank you all for coming out on a rainy night.